Things were changing at the magic shop. Leo Binky left to consult on a television show, and our store needed a new manager. Leo's replacement was a fortunate choice for me. Dave Stewart, emaciated, lanky, and deadpan, was an actual former vaudevillian who had worked the circuits with a magic act. He went by the name Lord Chesterfield, later changed to David and Company, because, he said, the company implied two people, and he could ask for more money. His act had been that of a stone-faced, bungling magician, which appealed to me because Jim Barlow's and my hero at the time was the king of bungling magicians, Carl Ballantyne, whose legendary appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show nudged every young magician toward comedy. Dave Stewart's vaudeville act had involved an ordinary-looking violin that he was always about to play but never did. His big finish, enabled by old-world craftsmanship, was its instantaneous transformation into a bouquet of flowers. One day he brought his trick violin to the store to share with this 16-year-old boy. He flicked a hidden switch, and I watched as the violin changed into a colorful bouquet of feather flowers. Nice, but then he showed me his opening joke. He walked from behind the counter and stood on the floor of the magic shop, announcing, "And now, the glove into dove trick." He threw a white magician's glove into the air. It hit the floor and lay there. He stared at it, and then went on to the next trick. It was the first time I had ever seen laughter created out of absence. I found this gag so funny that I asked permission to use it in my youthful magic act, and he said yes. He told me another bit. He would take out a white handkerchief, pretend to mop his brow, and then, thanks to a rubber ball sewn into the cloth, absent-mindedly bounce it on the floor. I didn't really get the joke, but the concept stuck. I took a high-bounce juggling ball and sewed it inside a realistic-looking cloth rabbit. Producing the bunny from a tube painted with Chinese symbols, I would say, "And now a live, bouncing baby rabbit." Then, to everyone's shock and eventual laughter, I would bounce the rabbit on the floor. I had my first original gag. Dave Stewart's stories intrigued me, and I developed an interest in the history of vaudeville. I read up on the subject, studying Joe Lory's book Vaudeville, and was captivated by its descriptions of each old-time act. It mentioned the Cherry Sisters, and it was here that I first heard an act described as so bad it was good. The five screeching sisters elicited boos and vegetables from the audience, and yet still made it to Broadway, a concept that the off-pitch singer Mrs. Miller succeeded with in the 60s, and that Andy Kaufman took to the limit in the 80s. My interests widened to carnival scams, thanks to the nearby Long Beach Pike and its boardwalk games and sideshow featuring Zuzu the Monkey Girl, Electra, a woman who could light light bulbs in her bare hand, and a two-headed baby resting in formaldehyde that was actually a convincing rubber facsimile. There was also a roller coaster called the Cyclone Racer, whose behemoth wooden skeleton extended out over the sea. I was hoping the carnies would let me in on their secrets, but they never did. Maybe it was my Ivy League button-down shirts that kept them from thinking I was one of them. The Main Street shop sold magic books. Rarely purchased, they gathered dust on a high shelf. A yellow cover caught my eye, and this book turned out to be more important to me than The Catcher in the Rye. It was Dariel Fitzke's Showmanship for Magicians, first published in 1943. The terse internet bio of Mr. Fitzke, who turned out, coincidentally, to be a distant relative by marriage, describes him this way. Born in Anawan, Illinois. Pen name of Dariel Fitzroy. Acoustical engineer in San Rafael, California. Semi-pro magician. Toured an unsuccessful full-evening show 1939 through 40. Reportedly dropped magic in disgust. Showmanship for Magicians is a handbook meant to turn amateurs into professionals. Its subtitle is Complete Discussions of Audience Appeals and Fundamentals of Showmanship and Presentation. I held my first copy and solemnly turned the pages, reading each sentence so slowly that it's a miracle I could remember what the verb was. The cover was plain-faced, like a secret manifesto that should be hidden under your mattress, and the pages were as thick as rags. Fitzke starts by denigrating the current state of magic, saying it is old-fashioned. Though published in 1943, this statement contains an enduring truth. All entertainment is, or is about to become, old-fashioned. There is room, he implies, for something new. To a young performer, this is a relief. My references were all in the past, and in just one chapter, these roots were severed, or at least choked. Fitzke then goes on to break down a show into elements such as music, rhythm, comedy, sex appeal, personality, and selling yourself, and he concludes that attention to each is vital and necessary. Why not throw everything in the book at the audience, like an opera does? Costumes, lights, music, everything. He also talks about something that was to land on me with a thud 6 years later, the importance of originality. So what, I thought at the time, who cares? Following the advice and showmanship from magicians, I kept scrupulous records of how each gag played after my local shows for the Cub Scouts or Kiwanis Club. Excellent, or big laugh, or quiet, I would write in the margins of my big Indian tablet. Then I would summarize how I could make the show better next time. I was still motivated to do a magic show with standard patter, but the nice response to a few gags had planted a nagging thought that contradicted my magical goal. They love it when the tricks don't work. I started to think that the future of a serious magician was limited. Plus, I was priced out of the market by the impossible cost of advanced stage illusions. Sawing a lady in half, $200. By doing comedy, however, I could be more like Stan Laurel and Jack Benny, more like Wally Bogue. I was still using Claude's somber introduction to my floating silver ball routine, but I added a twist at the end of the long-winded speech. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the toilet float trick. My time at the magic shop gave me a taste of performing and convinced me that I never wanted to wait on customers again. I didn't have the patience. My smile was becoming plastered on. I then crossed all kinds of jobs off my list of potentials, such as waiting tables or working in stores or driving trucks. How could my delicate fingertips, now dedicated to the swift execution of the two-handed pass, clutch the heavy, callus-inducing steering wheel of a 10-ton semi? But there was a problem. At age 18, I had absolutely no gifts. I could not sing or dance, and the only acting I did was really just shouting. Thankfully, perseverance is a great substitute for talent. Having been motivated by Earl Scruggs' rendition of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, I had learned, barely, to play the banjo. I had taught myself by slowing down banjo records on my turntable and picking out the songs note by note with a helpful assist from my high school friend John McEwen, already an accomplished player. The only place to practice without agonizing everyone in the house was in my car, parked on the street with the windows rolled up, even in the middle of August. Also, I could juggle passably, a feat I had learned from the talented Fantasyland court jester Christopher Fair, who could juggle five balls while riding a high unicycle, and which I practiced in my backyard using heavy wooden croquet balls that would clack against each other, pinching my swollen fingers in between. Despite a lack of natural ability, I did have the one element necessary to all early creativity, naivete, that fabulous quality that keeps you from knowing just how unsuited you are for what you are about to do. After high school graduation, I half-heartedly applied and was accepted at Santa Ana Junior College, where I took drama classes and pursued an unexpected interest in English poetry from Donne to Eliot. I had heard about a theater at Disneyland's friendly, striving rival, Knott's Berry Farm, that needed entertainers with short acts. One afternoon, I successfully auditioned with my thin magic act at a small theater on the grounds, making this the second happiest day of my life so far. My final day at the magic shop, I stood behind the counter where I had pitched Svengali decks and the Incredible Shrinking Die, and I felt an emotional contradiction, nostalgia for the present. Somehow, even though I had stopped working only minutes earlier, my future fondness for the store was clear, and I experienced a sadness like that of looking at a photo of an old favorite pooch. It was dusk by the time I left the shop, and I was redirected by a security guard who explained that a photographer was taking a shot, and would I please use the side exit? I did, and saw a small, thin woman with hacked brown hair aim her large format camera directly at the dramatically lit castle, where white swans floated in the moat underneath the functioning drawbridge. Almost 40 years later, when I was in my early 50s, I purchased that photo as a collectible, and it still hangs in my house. The photographer, it turned out, was Deanne Arbus. I try to square the photo's breathtakingly romantic image with the rest of her extreme subject matter, and I assume she saw this facsimile of a castle as though it were a kitsch roadside statue of Paul Bunyan, or perhaps she saw it as I did. Beautiful. The Birdcage Theater. During the 1960s, the 5-foot-high hand-painted placard in front of the Birdcage Theater at Knott's Berry Farm read, "World's Greatest Entertainment." The missing N in entertainment was overlooked by staff, audience, and visitors for an entire decade. I worked there between the ages of 18 and 22 as an actor in melodramas. Knott's Berry Farm didn't have the flash of its younger sibling, Disneyland, but it was authentic and charming. Knott's Berry Farm began in the 1930s when Walter and Cordelia Knott put up a roadside berry stand. A few years later, Cordelia opened her chicken dinner restaurant, and Walter bought pieces of a ghost town and moved the Old West buildings to his burgeoning tourist destination. Squawking peacocks roamed the grounds, and there was a little wooden chapel that played organ music while you stared at a picture of Jesus and watched his eyes magically open. My first performances for a paying audience were at the Birdcage, a wooden theater with a canvas roof. Inside, 200 folding chairs sat on risers, and a thrust Masonite stage sat behind a patch of fake grass. A painted cutout of a birdcage, worthy of a Sotheby's folk art auction, hung over center stage, and painted representations of drapes framed the proscenium. The actors swept the stage, raised and lowered the curtains, cleaned the house of trash, and went out on the grounds pitching the show to visitors strolling around the park. I was being paid $2 a show, 25 shows a week. Even in 1963, the rate was considered low. The show consisted of a 25-minute melodrama in which the audience was encouraged to cheer the hero and boo the villain. I appeared in The Bungling Burglar, performing the role of Hamilton Brainwood, a detective who was attracted to the provocatively named soubrette Dimples Reardon. Fortunately, I ended up with the virtuous heroine, Angela Trueheart. My opening night was attended by my high school girlfriend, Linda Rasmussen, and her parents, who, it turned out, were more nervous for me than I was. The play was followed by a 10-minute oleo segment involving 2 5-minute routines where the actors did their specialties, usually songs or short comedy acts. Though I didn't do an oleo that night, the Birdcage was the first place where I was able to work steadily on my magic act, 6 minutes at a time, 4 times a day, 5 on Sunday, for 3 years. The Birdcage was a normal theatrical nuthouse. Missed cues caused noisy pileups in the wings, or a missing prop left us hanging while we ad-libbed excuses to leave the stage and retrieve it. A forgotten line would hang in the dead air, searching for someone, anyone, to say it. The theater was run by Woody Wilson, a dead ringer for W.C. Fields, and a boozer, too, and the likable George Stewart, who, on Saturday night, would entertain the crowd with a monologue that had them roaring. "You're from Tucson? I spent a week there one night." 4 paying customers in a house that seated 200 was officially an audience, so we often did shows to resonating silence. Woody Wilson, on one of these dead afternoons, peed so loudly in the echoing bathroom that it broke up us actors and got laughs from our conservative family audience. The theater was stocked with genuine characters. Ronnie Morgan, Rail Finn, would dress up as Lincoln and read the Gettysburg Address for local elementary schools. On a good day, he would show us young lads cheesecake photos of his wife in a leopard-skin bikini, and even at age 18, we thought it was weird. There was Joe Carney, a blustery and funny actor who opened the lavatory door from the top to avoid germs. Paul Shackleton was the son of a preacher and could not tolerate a swear word, but he once laughed till he cried when we sat down under a eucalyptus tree to drink our Cokes and a bird shit on my head. His laughter made me think it was funny, too. And for days we could not look each other in the eye without breaking into uncontrollable hysterics. John Stewart, a talented tenor with a mischievous sense of humor, once secretly put talcum powder in my top hat. On stage, whenever I popped the hat on or off, a mushroom cloud of smoke bloomed from my head, causing an unscheduled laugh from the audience. Kathy Westmoreland, another actress at the theater, had attended Garden Grove High School at the same time I did, and she was the first indisputably talented person I ever met. She sang like the Swedish Nightingale, and later in life achieved a strange kind of celebrity. As a backup singer for Elvis, she became his confidant and then quietly his lover. Years later, after his death, she wrote a book revealing her secret, making her the focus of overwrought Elvis fans. Kathy and I developed a hillbilly routine, she on washtub bass and I on banjo. It was my first foray into comedy without magic to back me up. She blacked out a tooth, and the act included crossed eyes and corny jokes, and it absolutely killed. We soon ascended to the premier slot for the Birdcage Olio Acts, the Saturday night 9 o'clock performance. The audience would howl and weep and thrash about, and the laughs would double the length of our 5-minute show. We decided to take our act to the Golden Bear for a Monday tryout. The Bear was a folk music club in Huntington Beach, California, where all the big names played, including Kenny Rankin, John Mayall, Jackson Browne, and Hoyt Axton, an accomplished performer and songwriter himself, author of the oddly unforgettable lyric, "Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog." But it's hard to forget that his mother co-wrote Heartbreak Hotel. I was smug about presenting our fully broken in and seemingly invulnerable act. My belief in the inevitability of our success charged me up before, during, and after the show, and it was not until days later when I acknowledged to myself that our debut in the tougher world of real show business had been met with only polite response. Kathy and I were probably too corny for an exploding folk scene that was producing many serious and spectacular artists. The willing and forgiving audiences at the Birdcage did not necessarily reflect those at hip folk clubs. And then there was Stormy. Stormy Shirk, later to become an enormously successful Christian author and proselytizer under her married name Stormy Omardian, was beautiful, witty, bright, and filled with an engaging spirit that was not yet holy. We performed in plays together. My role was either the comic or the leading man, depending on the day of the week. She wore 19th-century style dresses that complemented her strawberry blonde hair and vanilla skin. Soon we were in love and would roam around knots in our period clothes and find a period place to sit, mostly by the period church next to the man-made lake, where we would stare endlessly into each other's eyes. We developed a love duet for the Birdcage in which she would sing "Gypsy Rover" while I accompanied her on the five-string. When she sang the song, the lyric that affected me most was, believe it or not, "La-dee-doo, la-dee-doo, dum day." We would talk of a wedding in a lilac-covered dale, and I could fill any conversational gaps with ardent recitations of Keats and Shelley. Finally, the inevitable happened. I was a late-blooming 18-year-old when I had my first sexual experience involving a condom swiped from my parents' drawer and the front seat of my car, whose windows became befogged with desire. Later, Stormy wrote in her autobiography that when she was a girl, her severely mentally ill mother would lock her in a dark closet for days, cruelly abusing her. I had no idea. If Stormy had said I would look good in a burgundy ball gown, I would have gone out and bought a burgundy ball gown. Instead, she suggested that I read W. Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge. The Razor's Edge is a book about a quest for knowledge, universal, final, unquestionable knowledge. I was swept up in the book's glorification of learning, and the idea that, like a stage magician, I could have secrets possessed by only a few. Santa Ana Junior College offered no philosophy classes, so I immediately applied to Long Beach State College, later renamed the loftier-sounding California State University at Long Beach, and enrolled with a major in philosophy. I paid for schooling out of my Birdcage wages, aided in my second year by a Dean's List scholarship, $180 a year, achieved through my impassioned studying, fueled by razor's edge romanticism. I rented a small apartment near school, so small that its street number was 1059 and a quarter. Stormy eventually moved an hour north to attend UCLA, and we struggled for a while to see each other. But without the metaphor of the 19th century to enchant us, we realized that our real lives lay before us, and, painfully for me, we drifted apart. At the Birdcage, I formed the soft primordial core of what became my comedy act. Over the 3 years I worked there, I strung together everything I knew, including Dave Stewart's glove and a dove trick, some comedy juggling, a few standard magic routines, a banjo song, and some very old jokes. My act was eclectic, and it took 10 more years for me to make sense of it. However, the opportunity for performing 4 and 5 times a day gave me confidence and poise. Even though my material had few distinguishing features, the repetition made me lose my amateur rattle.